Josephine Ward was focusing on the icy streets beneath her feet, trying her best not to slip when a scream rang out. The scream came from her friend, Christina, but Christina stared straight ahead. Jo turned to see her sister, Freda, and at first glance it appeared as though Freda was caught in a loving embrace, until her attacker turned to the side to reveal a bloody gash on the side of her sister's face. Jo grabbed at her umbrella as though it were a baseball bat and came at the assailant. The attacker lunged at Jo and slashed her collarbone, then dashed towards her little sister Freda, who was hobbling down the slick cobblestones towards the ferry landing. The assailant took chase, apparently unburdened by the icy conditions that handicapped poor Freda, for they quickly caught up and pulled Freda in close. Jo then saw a spray of blood and her sister crumpled to the ground. The assailant then sprung to their feet and dashed for an exit. "You dirty dog!" Jo screamed after them. "You'll hang for this!" "I don't care if I'm hung," they replied. "I want to die anyhow." Freda's body bled out on the cobblestone landing by the Mississippi River, before bystanders were able to load it onto a wagon to bring to the doctor's office. Christina was hysterical, and Jo herself needed medical attention. Jo impatiently waited as her cheek was stitched back up, then joined her family at the undertaker's. I'm your host, Elise, and this is the historical true crime podcast, Old Blood. Miss Higbee's School for Young Girls in Memphis, Tennessee, was one of the nicer schools in the area, but still typical of the education a young woman would receive in the late 1800s. The Higbee School had a demanding curriculum to prepare girls for one of the country's colleges for women, but its primary purpose was to train their students how to be proper young ladies. In discipline, the standard is that of a well-regulated Christian family, a pamphlet for the Higbee School reads. The principal, assisted by the presiding teachers, endeavors to supply the mother's place. For mothers who had trouble raising their girls, institutes like the Higbee School provided an appealing alternative. The girls were closely supervised and only allowed visitors on Saturday and Thursday evenings, and were never allowed to leave the school without explicit permission from the school or their family. It was a non-sectarian school, so each girl's family would choose which church she would attend, but all girls were expected to attend church each Sunday. The school's main objective was, quote, to give such moral culture as will best develop a true Christian womanhood, end quote. George Mitchell hoped the Higbee School would help his daughter Alice, who was not necessarily a bad girl, but one who had problem acting the true Christian woman. She wasn't into the things that other girls were into. She loathed embroidery and sewing, and preferred shooting and horseback racing, physical activities that were then thought to be boys' hobbies. She was a tomboy. George Mitchell thought the girls' school would help Alice, and besides, he had little faith in his wife Isabella, who suffered from a mental illness. So Mr. Mitchell sent Alice to Miss Higbee's, where she made friends, first with Lily Johnson, then later with Freda Ward and her older sister Jo. The four girls became close friends and did everything together. Still, everyone saw how Alice and Freda had become best friends, while Lily developed her friendship with Jo. People at school knew this because, back then, physical affection between girls was expected, and Alice and Freda gave each other a lot of it. The regional term for this was chumming, but open affection between girls, hugging, kissing, holding hands, that sort of thing, was not purely a regional thing. Chumming was thought of as a normal part of girlhood, almost like a preview for what would come later in marriage. It was normal then for girls to be very close and openly affectionate in ways that young girls just aren't today. The poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow called chumming a, quote, rehearsal in girlhood of the great drama of a woman's life, end quote. And for girls who were never supposed to discuss their feelings and desires for men, chumming became a sort of emotional outlet and means of affection that a girl away at boarding school might not otherwise get. Chumming was also a thing because lesbians weren't. There were women interested in other women, but the idea of lesbianism was not yet known or even really discussed. The term lesbian wouldn't even be used for another 40 years at least. So when girls became very close to each other, society had no choice to view their affection as chumming, or whatever the regional term for it was, and not same-sex love. In 1892, Memphis, Tennessee, a girl could not be a lesbian, because for them, same-sex love was unnatural, an abomination, and any girl who showed signs of loving a woman the way they were supposed to love a man, it was a sure sign that the girl was insane. Lesbianism in 1892 Memphis was, as historian Alexis Coe explains, an impossible idea. But the truth is that Alice and Freda fell in love with each other at Miss Higbee's School for Young Girls. How their relationship began is lost to time, but we do know that it began at Miss Higbee's. Joe and Lily became good friends and were always seen together, but Alice and Freda were on a different level with their chumming. So much so that they agreed they needed to tone it down a bit and lay off the kissing for a while, and perhaps just stick to handholding. But before any issues arose, Freda was forced to leave Miss Higbee's. She was moving to the city of Gold Dust, further south in Tennessee, to go live with her older sister Ada after the death of their mom. The move was hard on Alice and Freda's relationship, but they managed to find the silver lining in the situation. Because Freda moved so far away, when the two saw each other, it was often for weeks on end, meaning they would get to spend every minute of it together, and even get to share a bed at night. But when Freda moved to Gold Dust, she was starting a new life there, and their relationship suffered the anxiety of this. At what point would their parents expect them to marry and leave the home, ending their relationship forever? And though the two were committed to making a long-distance relationship work, Freda had no choice but to start a new life at her new home. And in Gold Dust, the fair Freda had many suitors, a fact which irked Alice to no end. Alice was uninterested in even trying to make it look like she was attracted to men, while Freda seemed flattered by the male attention. While the time away from Alice gave Freda a chance to form new friendships, the time they spent back together was increasingly filled with jealousy and anxiety. Alice visited Freda in Gold Dust once, and Alice spent a good deal of her time trying to get to know Freda's new friends and neighbors, trying to find out what she had been up to and who she had seen. She befriended several people there, trying to make contact with people who might help surveil Freda while Alice was back in Memphis. But Alice was seeing for herself how unfaithful Freda had been to her and confronted her about it, only for Freda to confess to have fallen in love with not one, but two men. That night, Alice obtained a bottle of poison and brought it to bed with her, unable to sleep. Freda woke in the night to see Alice and the bottle of poison, and was alarmed enough to stay awake the rest of the night, but stayed silent about the incident. The next morning, Alice boarded a stateroom of the steamer carrying her back to Memphis, then took the bottle of poison and downed it. "Marry whomever you want," she told Freda. Alice did not die. The poison was laudanum, and though it didn't kill her, the effects were pretty ugly. After she recovered, Alice began plotting other ways to end her heartache. Part of the problem was her family, Historians hint that her family might have been abusive to her, or at least unkind and unfair, and so Alice had always been distant from her parents and siblings. The only one Alice felt safe turning to was the family cook, Lucy Franklin, and she did not have any power to help either. Alice wanted out. She wanted to take Freda and get out of there before anyone could ruin things for them. It was only a matter of time before something or someone came between them, Alice knew, and she was desperate for a solution. The other part of the problem was the fact that she was not a man. Were she a man, she could marry Freda and make her his own, but she wasn't a man. She was a woman, and she had no rights to any of the things she wished for herself. Alexis Coe, who wrote the book Alice and Freda, explained, "To have Freda the way that Alice wanted her, she would need to have the power that a man had." So that must be the solution then, Alice thought. She would become a man. She would change her name to a man's, dress like one, and then use her newfound status and power to get a job to support herself and Freda. They would marry in Memphis at Freda's church, then elope, run away to St. Louis and live together forever as Mr. Alvin Ward and his wife. In February 1891, Alice committed her plans to paper and sent them to Gold Dust, along with her proposal. Freda finally replied to Alice that she would be happy to be her wife. Alice was happy about the response, but also a bit anxious. She felt that perhaps Freda wasn't taking her seriously, so she sent two more letters, double-checking. In three separate letters, Alice warned Freda that she was absolutely serious, that their marriage was as serious as any other. Three times she told her that if Freda agreed to marry her, she would belong to Alice, and disloyalty meant death. If Freda broke off their engagement, Alice promised to kill her for it, Coe wrote. Freda swore to be true, and Alice began saving up for their elopement. She had an engagement ring engraved from A to F and sent it to Freda, who was focused on her role in the relationship as the true woman. She tried her best to soothe Alice, writing to her in July of 1891. "Sweet love, you know that I love you better than anyone in the wide world. I am trying not to love others, and when I stop loving A and A, I will tell you. I know that you are awfully jealous, sweet, but try not to be. You don't know how much I worship you, sweetheart. I will be perfectly happy when I become Mrs. Alvin J. Ward." Alice responded in August, "I am too jealous. I love you, Fred, and would kill Ashley before I would see him take you from me. You think I'm only saying that for fun, but I really mean it. Sweet one, you have done me mean, but I love you still with all your faults." Finally, after months of planning, the day had come and the girls were prepared to elope. Freda was home in Gold Dust, waiting until nightfall, but so was her older sister slash surrogate mother, Ada Volkmar, who managed to unravel their plot only earlier that day. Alice never behaved poorly in front of her, but Ada always thought something was a bit off about her. Her suspicions were confirmed when Ada read through the girls' letters and, even through their disguised words, she finally saw the truth, finally saw what she had previously been blind to. Freda and Alice were behaving as boyfriend and girlfriend, and worse, they planned to run away together. It would ruin Freda's reputation, her life. It would ruin the entire family's reputation. Alice was stood up and had no clue what had happened until several days later, when two letters arrived for the Mitchells, one for Alice's mother and the other for Alice. Ada Volkmar wrote to Alice that she was mistaken to think Freda did not have someone watching out for her, and that she was never to contact Freda in any way from that point forward. Ada returned the engagement ring that Alice had given Freda, and Alice reconciled herself to the truth of what she already knew. Deep down, the world would not allow her and Freda to be together. Freda was taken away from her, just as she worried she would be. The loss sent Alice spiraling into a deep depression. She stopped eating and withdrew herself from the family completely. Alice convinced her own parents that Ada was simply crazy, but they also warned her to sever contact with Freda anyway. Alice confided only in the family cook, Lucy Franklin, who allowed her to hide a keepsake box in the kitchen. She would often visit the box and run her fingers along the photograph and keepsake that reminded her of Freda. Her family grew concerned when Alice's depression worsened, and she began to behave oddly. On 5 different occasions, Alice signed for things using Freda's name rather than her own. It was a genuine mistake, she said. She was thinking of Freda and not paying attention. She did her best to keep tabs on Freda through their mutual friends, and even wrote to one of Freda's suitors, Ashley Roselle. More importantly, Alice was desperate to find out when Freda would return to Memphis. Finally, Alice got word that Freda was planning a visit. Freda had thus far been silent, heeding her sister's warnings to stay clear of Alice. Knowing that Freda loved to be courted, Alice sent 2 letters to Freda when she arrived in Memphis anyway. When Alice received one of the returned letters, she was shocked to find Freda's handwriting on the envelope, reading, "Return." Seeing Freda's handwriting was devastating to Alice, who was already teetering on insanity, who had already snuck into her father's bedroom one November night and stole his razor. George Mitchell went searching for it, but Alice kept it hidden in the pocket of her dress, just in case she ever ran into Freda. She had promises to keep, even if Freda did not. Knowing Freda was in Memphis, Alice began scouting the town for any sight of her. She knew where she would be staying, so she took out the buggy for a ride around town, often with her friend Lily Johnson, who had been best friends with her, Freda, and Joe at Miss Higby's. Lily was unaware of the romance between Freda and Alice, and thought that Alice was upset just as Lily was that their best friends had suddenly cut off all contact with them. Lily understood that Alice was having a harder time saying goodbye than her. One afternoon, Alice got lucky. She spotted Freda downtown, walking down the street and into a photograph gallery. Alice stationed herself outside the store, her heart thumping in her chest and her fingers, grasping the razor in her dress pocket, waiting for Freda's exit. When she finally left the gallery, Freda walked straight towards Alice, and then right past her as though Alice was not even there. Freda had certainly seen her. Her best friend and lover standing in front of her in broad daylight, yet she pretended not to have seen her. Alice was so shocked by Freda's rejection that she forgot all about the razor blade in her pocket. On January 18, Alice finally received a letter from Freda. "Dear Allie," it read, "I love you now and always will, but I have been forbidden to speak to you and I must obey. You say I am as much to blame as you are. If I have done you any harm or caused you any trouble, I humbly beg your forgiveness. Please don't let anyone know you wrote this. No one knows about that last summer's business except our family." Alice was gutted. Freda swore to be true to her, to obey her and only her. They were to marry and spend the rest of their lives together, and now Freda was choosing to obey her sister Ada instead of her. Freda broke her promise. Freda ended her letter by saying that she was to depart back to Goldust that evening, but Alice knew this couldn't be true. Even Alice, totally unconnected with much of the world around her, knew there would be no steamer in Memphis that night because of bad weather. It would be days before the next departure. Freda had lied. On January 21st, 1892, Alice penned a response. Don't write to me anymore, and if you do, I'll write to your sister Ada. Alice reminded her of how Freda snubbed her on the street the other day, and then told her that she knew Freda lied about the steamer departure. I suppose you will go home on the Aurelie tomorrow, or wait for the Rosalie Monday. The subtext was clear. You lied, and I know it. I know when you're leaving, and I will see you there. On the 23rd, Alice and Lily Johnson went riding around town in their buggy. Lily was used to going around with Alice looking for answers. She knew how hurt Alice had been about Freda and Joe severing contact with them, and Lily too wanted answers. And then again, these were teenage girls with not much else to do. Riding around town to see what was going on was kind of the thing to do anyway. So Lily thought nothing of it when she hopped in the buggy and it started heading towards the waterfront. And then toward the Widow Kimbrough's house where the Ward sisters were staying. They watched as Freda and Joe Ward left the house, along with their mutual friend Christina Purcell. The trio began walking towards the river, confirming Alice's theory that they would leave on the steamer Aurelie that evening. Panic set in. Alice might never see Freda again. She knew how many suitors Freda had, knew it was only a matter of time before she was married and out of Alice's reach forever. Alice drove the buggy past the three girls and then pulled over out of the way. When the girls caught up, Alice and Freda locked eyes momentarily, and Alice hopped out of the buggy. "Where are you going?" Lily asked. "I'm going to see Fred once more," she replied. She then made her way to the cobblestone landing connected to the Mississippi River. Freda hurried ahead, walking as fast as possible without slipping on the snowy stones that slanted down toward the river, but it was taking her a while. Alice, however, was determined and caught up to the three girls by the time they were passing the custom house. She was partly hidden by the crowd, and was trying to sneak up to Freda and catch her alone for what she was about to do, but Christina Purcell turned and recognized her old friend Alice. Alice rushed to Freda and wrapped her arm around her. Christina thought she was forcing a hug on Freda until Alice abruptly pulled back and Freda let out a yelp. Christina screamed upon seeing the bloody gash on Freda's cheek, prompting Joe to turn around to see what was happening. Joe swung her umbrella at Alice. "Leave my sister alone," she yelped. Alice had slashed Freda's face with the razor blade, and then was forced to deal with Joe. She dodged the umbrella and reached out with the razor, slashing at Joe's collarbone as well. Joe fell back, and Alice followed the bloody trail to Freda, who was hobbling towards the steamer, towards safety. It didn't take long for Alice, fueled by adrenaline and desperation, to catch up. Alice slid her father's razor into Freda's neck and slit her throat from ear to ear. Blood sprayed onto Alice, and Freda crumpled to the cobblestones, where a crimson puddle formed beneath her. Alice then dashed up to the levee to where Joe was screaming at her, "Alice, you dirty dog, you'll hang for this." "I don't care if I'm hung," she replied. "I want to die anyhow." This wasn't how Alice envisioned things happening. She was hoping for a chance to be alone, to say goodbye. She had hoped to die with Freda, to turn the razor on her own throat afterwards so that they could die in each other's arms. But then Joe intervened, and then, later in all of the drama, Alice lost track of the razor. Lily was back in the buggy getting impatient when she spotted Alice running toward her. Something was off in her movements, but it wasn't until Alice got closer that Lily knew for sure something terrible had happened. Alice was soaked in blood. "Oh!" Lily gasped. "What have you done to her?" "I have cut Freda's throat."
"No, you haven't."
"Have you?"
"Yes, I have," Alice responded, and then asked, "What's the quickest way I can kill myself?"
Lily panicked. "Don't do it while you are here with me. Go home and tell your mother what you have done." Lily moved to wipe off some of Freda's blood that covered Alice's dress and face, but Alice stopped her.
"It's Freda's blood," she cried. "Leave it there. I love her so." In the end, Alice did end up returning to the Mitchell home, where her father would arrange for her to be handed over for her arrest. Jo was receiving stitches for her wound, and then would meet her parents at the undertaker's, where Freda's body was growing cold. Alice's father, George Mitchell, was known around Memphis as Uncle George. He was a beloved member of the community and a retired senior partner of a furniture company. When his wife, Isabella, had their first child, she developed postpartum depression, which they referred to as puerperal insanity. George had his wife declared insane and then committed her to an asylum, where her depression morphed into insanity and mania. When she finally, supposedly, recovered, after 2 months, she went home to reunite with her newborn, only to find that the child had died while she was away. The death made her ill all over again, yet this time Isabella tried not to let her distress be so visible so as to not be sent back to the asylum. Of the 7 children Isabella gave birth to, only 4 of them lived to adulthood. And after each pregnancy, she suffered postpartum depression, which was interpreted by her husband and society as insanity. So he and everyone else treated her like she was an insane woman. After his daughter slit another girl's throat, George Mitchell decided that insanity must run in the family. Of course, Alice had become insane. She was her mother's daughter, after all. And then there was the fact that the crime Alice committed was an impossible one. Well-to-do white women simply did not slit throats. Even if they crossed the gender boundary to kill someone, it was usually done with a woman's weapon, like poison, and definitely not in the bloodiest, most horrific way possible. That was a man's crime. But even if Alice's society were to understand that women are capable of committing a man's crime, they still would not have been able to understand Alice's motive, because, to them, women did not fall in love with other women. It just could not happen. It was an impossibility. And yet, Alice had killed Freda, screaming that she loved her and wanted to marry her. So how could this be? For George Mitchell and the authorities of Memphis, Tennessee, the answer was simple. Alice Mitchell was insane. George arranged for his daughter's surrender to the police, who assured him that his daughter would be well taken care of. Lily Johnson was also arrested for allegedly aiding Alice in the crime, despite her pleas to the contrary, so the two girls did time together in jail, even sharing the same cell since there was a lack of rooms there. Lily was not afraid of Alice per se, but of the entire situation, so her father came to stay and keep an eye on her as much as he could. It was an innocent suggestion for Lily to tell Alice to go home and tell her mom what she had done. Lily was telling Alice to obey her mom, just as she had been told to do her entire life, and yet authorities interpreted this as her aiding and abetting in the murder. Lily would eventually be acquitted, but not before being imprisoned, harassed by authorities, and had her name slandered in papers throughout the country. George Mitchell hired the 2 best lawyers in Tennessee at the time, Colonel George Grant and General Luke Wright, who would later be an ambassador to Japan and then the Secretary of War under President Teddy Roosevelt. The Mitchells and their lawyers got to work on their defense, but really, they weren't presenting anything new, anything the papers weren't already saying. The news repeated words like unnatural and strange, inverted and perverted, and to get their readers to fully understand what they were talking about without having to use words like lesbian or gay, which meant nothing to them, they explained how, in their relationship, Alice liked to pretend to be the man and Freda, the woman. Papers struggled to describe their relationship because How do you talk about something that isn't supposed to exist? All they could do was hint and make remarks that their readers would hopefully piece together to realize that these two girls were in love with each other and that Alice had killed Freda out of jealousy. But of course, the motive couldn't really be jealousy to a society that refused to believe in same-sex love, so instead, everyone mutually agreed that the most logical way to resolve all of these contradictions was to call Alice insane, rather than the system itself. On July 18, 1892, Alice's attorneys entered a plea of present insanity, essentially saying that Alice was incompetent to stand trial. Should Alice be granted the plea, she would not be clear of the murder charges, they would simply be postponed. It would then be up to the prosecution to decide whether or not to charge her at a later date if she healed and became competent to stand trial. But most knew that this was unlikely to happen, particularly with a young white woman like Alice. So the trial Alice was to face would not be for murder, it would be about her sanity. Alice's lawyers got a head start on their case by releasing a preview of Alice's mental state to the newspapers in an article titled The Hypothetical Case, and it gave a play-by-play of her mental state throughout life, emphasizing the ways in which she had proven herself insane, or, at the very least, not like the other girls. For one, Alice was a tomboy. She shunned the feminine in favor of masculine hobbies like shooting and horseback riding. She enjoyed baseball and football, playing with marbles and tops. She hated sewing and embroidery. Quote, "Her mother undertook to teach her crocheting, but could not," the defense argued. A neighbor of hers, George Perry, later testified at the insanity hearing, saying, "I have never considered her strong mentally. Her manner has always been flighty and unsettled, and her ways different from that of most girls." He emphasized how he saw her playing with a rifle and shooting at sparrows, once even speed racing on a horse, bareback. And then there was the butcher who had called Alice a tomboy, and, gasp, she did not balk or tell him he was wrong. Her attorney Gant also wrote in the Memphis Appeal Avalanche that, quote, "Everything she has done, her peculiarities, whether during her infancy she played with dolls or other such toys in which the average female delights, whether she had a fondness for those of her own or the opposite sex, all of these will be circumstances going to show the state and quality of her mind." And then there were all of Alice's other peculiarities. For one, she was left-handed, a sure sign of the devil reincarnated. Her face was asymmetrical, with one side appearing more full than the other, again, a sign of an imbalance. Doctors observing her also discovered that Alice suffered from nosebleeds when she was 12, about the same time when she would have begun menstruating, so they diagnosed her with vicarious menstruation, as proof there was something unnatural about her biologically. And then there was her depression and suicidal behavior, the poison she downed after Freda confessed to loving two men. And Lucy Franklin, the house cook and Alice's confidant, took the stand and recalled the time Alice almost blew off her own head with a rifle, by accident, apparently. The defense also pointed to Alice's lack of interest in men. "She was sometimes rude and always indifferent to young men," the defense argued. Lily Johnson's brother James testified about the time he had asked Alice to dance, and she rejected him in favor of continuing to swing in a hammock with Lily. Her sister Addie also agreed that Alice had not shown interest in men and refused to even speak to them on different occasions. Hear that, ladies? If you don't want to dance or talk to a man, you're an insane person. Just letting you know. Doctors incorrectly diagnosed Alice with erotomania. The defense avoided all mention of sexual activity, but did make it a point to note that Alice was a sexual pervert. This was not to be confused with being a sexually depraved person, since there was still no evidence of sexual activity. allegedly. But still, Alice's unnatural love for the same sex made her a sexual pervert, according to them. And this is where doctors brought in the idea of erotomania. The term was defined in an 1892 book as insanity where there is an intensely morbid desire towards a person of the opposite sex, which had been its definition for some 2 centuries. Doctors at the time of the insanity hearing simply had no existing terms to accurately describe Alice's state, so they hijacked the term and redefined it to mean having, quote, an unnatural affection between 2 persons of the same sex, in order to have a medical-sounding term to diagnose Alice with. In order for the present insanity plea to work, Alice's lawyers also had to prove hereditary influence, that she inherited her insanity from her mother. This part wasn't hard, seeing as George Mitchell already had his wife Isabella committed and declared insane on several occasions. But the most damning evidence of Alice's insanity came simply from the fact that she loved another woman. The doctors all assumed that Alice simply just had no idea how love and life even worked. They all agreed that she had low intelligence. Perhaps this was why she couldn't understand the concept of marriage. Alice, do you not know that you could not have married another young lady? The doctor asked her. Oh, I could have married Freda, she replied. But someone usually has to support a family in a case like that. She replied that she planned on working to support them. But a girl like you could not earn enough for both, he retorted. But I was going to dress as a man, she said. But, Miss Mitchell, do you not know that usually when young people get married, they look forward to the time when they shall have children growing up around them? No, she said, we were not going to have children. How do you know you were not? Oh, I know we were not, she replied, perhaps wondering if he was the one who didn't know how baby-making worked. But to the doctor and her lawyers, Alice's declaration that they did not have to plan children was further evidence of her insanity, for no girl in her right mind would not want to have children. Historian Alexis Coe wrote, Alice could not reproduce with Freda. The idea that a woman's pleasure could exist outside of procreation was inconsistent with society's understanding of sexuality. The doctor finished his questioning and then noted her responses were, quote, evidence either of a gross delusion or the conception of a person imbecile, end quote. Alice was no imbecile, though. In fact, she was ahead of her time in understanding that marriage was not simply for procreation. Alice was not dumb for believing she could marry Freda. If anything, Alice was just wrong to think that her society would let her get away with it. If there was evidence of Alice being mentally unwell, it was in the crime itself, not her motivations. Her attorney, Luke Wright, questioned her during the hearing, asking, "Why did you cut her?" "Because," Alice responded, "I knew I could not have her and did not want anyone else to have her." "You intended to kill her?" "Yes." "Now, Alice, why did you kill her?" "I killed her because I loved her," she said. Memphis newspapers later reported her as saying, "I resolved to kill Freda because I loved her so much that I wanted her to die loving me. And when she did die, I know she loved me better than any other human being on earth. I got my father's razor and made up my mind to kill Freda, and now I know she is happy." Again, Alice is not crazy for loving Freda, but she was crazy to think that Freda was happy after having her throat slit. In the end, neither the defense nor the prosecution could find 1 single doctor to testify to Alice being sane. Not one. The wards insisted that they had known Alice for quite some time and knew that she was perfectly sane, just the same as the rest of them. But if this were true, they would have to resign to the truth that Alice, in a sane mind, had loved and planned to marry another woman. And they just couldn't wrap their minds around this idea. If a woman was in love with another woman, she must be insane, they argued. There was no other way around it. Not a single doctor attended the insanity hearing to attest to her sanity. Her love for a woman was enough to prove it, Coe wrote. No further tests needed. Presiding over the courtroom and the all-white, all-male jury was Judge Julius J. DuBose. The Southern judge was born onto his father's plantation, run by slave labor, and evidently had a wild youth in which he stabbed someone to death after an argument in Arkansas. When he grew up, DuBose became a founding member of the Tennessee Ku Klux Klan. And that should tell you pretty much everything you need to know about Judge DuBose. He was described once as intolerant and despotic, a misogynist and avowed bigot, and in another article as Klan leader, crime boss, and judge all in one. He ruled Alice's insanity hearing with an iron fist and made a show of his power at every chance he got. Women in the courtroom were constantly reminded that they were there at the judge's discretion and that he would have them thrown out at any time he wished. Which he did, to one unlucky woman whom the judge said he just didn't like looking at. Sarah Davis was nicknamed Buckskin Lou by the press for having darker skin than the two white women on either side of her. DuBose decided he didn't like her and asked her to leave. When she refused, saying that she had a right to be there, the judge had her arrested. On another occasion, one spectator was arrested for blocking his path that day. While Alice was in jail, three black men were taken there after defending a black child from a white man's beatings outside of People's Grocery, a black-run grocery business. The white man who held a monopoly on the Memphis grocery scene jumped into the fray only to be clubbed over the head. He then led police to the People's Grocery, where three black men were arrested and taken to the jail where Alice had been staying. Several days after the grocery incident, Judge DuBose told his sheriffs to, quote, shoot down on sight any Negro who appears to be making trouble, end quote. 75 men invaded the jail and kidnapped the three prisoners, dragged them to a railroad yard, and then shot and killed all three. These lynchings were part of what inspired activist Ida B. Wells to launch her anti-lynching campaign. One of the murdered men was her friend, whose last words were, tell people to go west. There is no justice for them here. When Judge DuBose was not too busy lynching innocent citizens, he was fixing up the courthouse, his stage. He realized how many people would be interested in the Alice Mitchell case, and knew many of the country's major newspapers would send the reporters to cover it. DuBose delayed Alice's trial for a month in order to enlarge the courtroom, remodel it, and add in a press box where he would give journalists the best seats. Alice would not escape from Judge DuBose, but the following year, other prominent Memphis attorneys worked to impeach him for tyrannical and brutal outrages, including taking bribes and sexual assault. DuBose was eventually convicted on two counts and barred from holding office in the state of Tennessee. As for Alice's fate, all five doctors agreed with the defense's argument that she was presently insane while killing Freda. All five said she was both insane and incurable. The jury was out for a mere 20 minutes before returning with a verdict. Presently insane. Her only hope was healing and rehabilitation at the Western Hospital for the Insane in Bolivar, Tennessee. Alice apparently thought it hilarious that she was found crazy. According to the Bolivar Bulletin, the young lady seemed highly amused at being dubbed a lunatic as she left the courtroom for jail. Alice requested to visit Freda's grave along the way to the asylum. Freda's funeral took place at Grace Episcopal Church,
where Freda had attended Sunday school and sung in the church choir. Also, where Freda and Alice planned to marry, and the service was given by the same pastor that the girls hoped might marry them. 17-year-old Federica Ward was placed into a coffin with a glass viewing screen and was covered in white flowers, the symbol of innocence and purity. She was buried at Elmwood Cemetery, where Alice stopped on her way to the Bolivar Insane Asylum, falling to her knees and sobbing on top of Freda's grave. Alice was 23 when she arrived at Bolivar. The press, eager to announce a return to the status quo, reported that Alice was doing quite well there. She was no longer the aberration of society that she once was. She now miraculously enjoyed needlework and sewing. She was happy now and feminine, Coe wrote, vindicating their way of life. It was not a miracle, though. It was a lie. Alice was not doing well and never would. The asylum was 3 years old by this point and held 319 patients out of its capacity of 300. It was overcrowded and unsanitary, and doctors then had no idea how to treat mental illnesses anyway. And though some described Alice, in a pretty little room, as a bright, happy, laughing girl, others, like the Bolivar Bulletin, declared, "Her insanity is progressive, and it is only a question of time when this victim of erotic mania will be a driveling idiot through the decay of brain tissue." This is also not true, in case you couldn't tell. Alice was not a driveling idiot, and her brain tissue was not decaying. But she was suffering in Bolivar. Alice Mitchell died there, in the asylum, at the age of 25, in March of 1898. The papers say she died of consumption, and that she had been wasting away, while others speculated that she had been starving herself. Historian Coe points out how between 1896 and 1898, 23 out of 69 deaths at the Bolivar Asylum were from tuberculosis, so it's certainly possible that is, in fact, what Alice died from. On the asylum's patient rolls, there was no cause of death listed at all for Alice Mitchell, leading others to speculate that perhaps she had finally killed herself. Malcolm Rice Patterson, who helped with Alice's defense, and later became governor of Tennessee, allegedly confessed the truth years later. Quote, "Those closest to the case know she had taken her own life by jumping into a water tank on top of the building," Patterson claimed. Whatever the cause of her death, Alice Mitchell's body was transported back to Memphis and buried at Elmwood Cemetery, less than a quarter mile from where her lover, Freda, is buried. When Alice murdered Freda, society was just beginning to study homosexuality. Doctors later questioned Alice's insanity diagnosis, thinking perhaps Alice truly was motivated by love. Coe notes that it wasn't until the 1950s that Alfred Kinsey began researching homosexuality and developed the Kinsey Scale, which measured degrees of homosexuality, but this focused more on males than females. Doctors began studying lesbians in prisons in the early 1900s, but studied them in the way Alice was, as a specimen of abnormality. Historian Lisa Dugan explains that academics credit scholar Carol Smith Rosenberg for bringing the discussion of women loving women from, quote, "a minor theme in medical and asylum journals into polite and influential circles," end quote. It wasn't until the civil rights movements of the 1960s that lesbianism was discussed in any serious way in the United States. Modern academics have been able to discuss the murder and Alice's intentions more accurately, yet in 1892, her motive was utterly inconceivable, says Coe. Coe thinks there was more to the situation than Alice's doctors let on, suggesting that besides her heartbreak with Freda, Alice was unhappy in other areas of her life as well, and that her family had been unkind to her.
Co argued that Alice wanted out of her family home, out from under the control of her father and brothers. I don't think she wanted to be a man, Co argued. She wanted the rights afforded to men. She wanted the authority that in 1892 Memphis was only available to white men. Moreover, Alice felt alone. She had no other examples of same-sex love to look to. The prosecution wanted to argue that Alice got the idea of women loving women from trashy French literature, but the truth is that Alice did not have access to literature like that in Memphis. She might have felt as though she were the only girl in the world who felt as she did about other women. That is, until she fell in love with Freda. And for Alice, Freda might have seemed like her last chance at happiness. What would happen to Alice without Freda? She would be married off into an equally intolerable situation for her. Alice dared to dream of the life she wanted. Freda as her own, the two living together happily ever after in St. Louis, with Alice dressed as a man, with Alice having the power of a man. And then these dreams had been crushed, and Alice was forced to realize the reality of her situation. No one would ever allow her to be with the woman she loved. As long as she lived, Alice's life would forever be a sham, a miserable countdown until death. Co speculated that perhaps if Alice had other examples of lesbians to look to, she might not have felt so alone, so desperate. Perhaps if she knew there were others out there, like her and Freda, she might have realized that the world had more to offer her. Alice did not know this, though. On that cold January afternoon, all Alice knew was Freda. To be clear, Alice and Freda had many faults, particularly Alice, who displayed abusive behavior towards Freda before murdering her. If Alice were a man and did what she did in today's society, everyone would describe her behavior towards Freda as coercive control. Alice's actions were wrong. It was wrong for her to control and murder Freda. There is no doubt about that. But Alice's motive? Her love for another woman? That was pure. There was nothing crazy about that. Murder is wrong. Love is not. And sometimes it's the society that's crazy, not the individual. Thanks for returning for another episode of Old Blood. Episode 42 is coming in 3 weeks. To support us, please leave us a kind rating or review on whatever platform you use to listen. Don't forget to catch all of the extra photos and documents I post on social media. You can find us by searching for Old Blood Podcast or by going to oldbloodpodcast.com. Music credits to Facilian Studios.